Clearwater Country Show. I'm going to play a little music here. And then when we get back, we'll jump right into the Wilderness Ethic. This is KRFP Moscow.
Remind us so we won't forget our origin.
KRFP is supported by
Tie-Dye Everything, specializing in locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located behind Mikey's at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. You can also find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com. KRFP is also supported by
Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006, including 3- and 4-bedroom apartments and houses. For more information, you can reach Isaac at 208-882-6442 or PonderosaRentals at hotmail.com.
For more information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Great to be with you here. You are listening to KRFP Moscow. Check them out, www.krfp.org. See how you can get involved in your grassroots community radio station. So One quick reminder here, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. The views expressed on the Wild Clearwater Country Show are those of the individuals speaking during the show and not necessarily those of KRFP Radio Free Moscow or any other organizations. So with that being said, I figured we'd jump right into our topic of today, which is wilderness. And first, we're going to talk a little bit about this very toxic, very poisonous Sportsman's Heritage Act and how that threatens the Wilderness Act of 1964 and the resulting National Wilderness Preservation System. The second part of the show, we're going to read a passage called The Wilderness Ethic out of the Locksaw Story, which was written by Bud Moore. And then towards the back end of the show, maybe we'll go, got out of a meeting yesterday, and on the back end of the show, I think we're going to talk a little bit about the group, the Alliance for the Wild Rockies, and all the great work that they are doing across the Northern Rockies bioregion. So nonetheless, got their newsletter here in the studio up at the FOC office, and so swing on by if you do want to get a free copy. We've got a bunch of copies outside the Friends of the Clearwater office, which is located on the second floor, room 211, 116 East 3rd Street. Take the staircase between Deadbeat Records and the Shirt Shack, and located up on the second floor is the FOC office. So nonetheless, how the Sportsman's Heritage Act of 2012, which is known as H.R. 4089, so that's the name of the bill, how the Sportsman's Heritage Act of 2012 would effectively repeal the Wilderness Act, which is America's foremost conservation law. Now, here's a quote of Howard Zonizer, who is the author of the Wilderness Act. The purpose of the Wilderness Act is to preserve the wilderness character of the areas to be included in the wilderness system, not to establish any particular use. Introduction here. On April 17, 2012, the U.S. House of Representatives passed H.R. 49, the Sportsman's Heritage Act, supposedly to, quote, protect and enhance opportunities for recreational hunting, fishing, and shooting. Unquote. But the bill is a thinly disguised measure to gut the 1964 Wilderness Act and protections for every unit of the National Wilderness Preservation System. How, you say? H.R. 49 would give hunting, fishing, recreational shooting, and fish and wildlife management top priority in wilderness rather than protecting the area's wilderness character, as has been the case for nearly 50 years. This bill would allow endless, extensive habitat manipulations in wilderness under the guise of wildlife conservation and for providing hunting, fishing, and recreational shooting experiences. It would allow the construction of roads to facilitate such uses and would allow the construction of dams, buildings, or other structures within the wilderness. It would also exempt all of these actions from NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. Finally, H.R. 49 would remove Wilderness Act prohibition against motor vehicle use for fishing, hunting, or recreational shooting, or for wildlife conservation measures. AKA, the Sportsman's Heritage Act will destroy the Wilderness Act as we know it. Now, here's a little background here. The Wilderness Act is widely considered America's foremost conservation law. It was a bipartisan masterpiece introduced in the Senate by Hubert Humphrey, Democrat from Minnesota, and in the House by John Saylor, Republican from Pennsylvania. The Wilderness Bill passed with nearly unanimous support, only one dissenting vote in the House and 12 in the Senate. The wilderness system has grown from 9 million acres in 1964 to nearly 110 million acres today. But the wilderness law itself has remained virtually unchanged. Born in America, the wilderness idea has spread to dozens of countries around the globe, yet the Wilderness Act and the National Wilderness Preservation System remain the envy of the world. Sadly, H.R. 49 would eviscerate the letter, the spirit, and the fundamental ideals expressed in this seminal law. So what can you do? There's a number of ways that you can help us try and defeat the Sportsman's Heritage Act. Number one, you can write or email Senator Harry Reid, who is the Senate Majority Leader, and you can write or email or phone, for that fact, Senator Jeff Bingaman, who's the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Senator Harry Reid can be reached at the phone number 202-224-3542. You can send him a snail mail letter at Senator Harry Reid, 522 Hart Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C., 20510. If you want to get in touch with Senator Jeff Bingaman, you can give him a phone call, his aides a phone call at 202-224-5521. You can send him a letter at Senator Jeff Bingaman, Chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, 703 Hart Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C., 20510. If you want to look at the website or the web contact form for these senators, you can go to Senator Reid's site at www.reid, which is R-E-I-D, .senate.gov, or you can go to Senator Bingaman's site at www.bingaman, which is bingaman.senate.gov. Now, if you send a letter or an email to Senator Reid or Senator Bingaman, also please send one to your U.S. senator and representative. Send a copy to, so in this case, if you live in this area, you would send letters to Senator Risch and Senator Crapo, and also to Representative Labrador. In your letter, please make sure that you ask Senators Reid and Bingaman to oppose H.R. 49 and its twin bill, Senate Bill 2066, at every step of the way, and do not let it pass the Senate. Now, talking points. Oppose H.R. 49 and S. 2066, which is its equivalent in the Senate. Both laws gut the Wilderness Act and strip protection from every single unit of the National Wilderness Preservation System across the entire country. Second talking point to consider. Massive human manipulations of fish, wildlife, and habitat, like those allowed by H.R. 49 and Senate Bill 2066, should not be allowed in our precious wilderness, or they will cease to be wilderness. Talking point number three, H.R. 49 and Senate Bill 2066 would allow agencies to build roads and use motor vehicles in wilderness and construct dams, buildings, and other structures with any connection to fish and wildlife. Talking point number four, environmental review under NEPA must not be waived by H.R. 49. Now, if you want to learn more about an analysis that was done by the group Wilderness Watch, which we have had as a guest here, both in studio and on the telephone here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show, go to the Wilderness Watch website, www.wildernesswatch.org, and then on the right-hand sign there, you're going to see an action alert that will take you to the Wilderness Watch's analysis, which is about 2-3 pages long, about H.R. 49. Please, whatever you can do, take the time to oppose these bad bills. Never has there been such an attempt to destroy the Wilderness Act and the very idea of wildness. So, with that being said, I figured we'd take a short music break, and then when we get back, we will read the Wilderness Ethic chapter from Bud Moore's Loxaw Story. Please stay with us. You're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. This is KRFP, Moscow.
Imminence, turbulence, inevitable. For it is the way of creation and perpetual balance, chaos in beauty. Awake now and carry the responsibilities of endlessness, messengers of timelessness. Infinity, the future of the past, and the rebirth of the next world to be. May Earth's children heed the messengers, the ones who bring the voices of the past, for they are the voices of our ancestors who belong to the future and will welcome you around the fire of destiny, the fire without an end.
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. So nice to be with you here. You are listening to KRFP Moscow. Check it out, www.krfp.org. And so we were talking about wilderness here today, and specifically the Sportsman's Heritage Act and the threats that that brings to not only the Wilderness Act, but to the National Wilderness Preservation System. And so certainly that is something that we all need help with, or all need to help as much as we can to kind of defeat that legislation. So the next thing we wanted to talk about is the read a chapter from the Lhasa story. It was written by Bud Moore. It's called Land Ethics in the Bitterroot Mountains. And one of the chapters is called The Wilderness Ethic. And it goes like this. Speaking in retrospect of his trapping activities during the 1920s, Earl Malone seemed possessed by something more than trapping furs and outwitting rangers when he said, quote, I thought, I can't express. There's something about that country that gives you a feeling you don't get anywhere else. It's just like nature created it. I think it's a wonderful country, and I think we should keep it that way forever. But to, quote, keep it that way forever was not what the rangers inside or the growing throng of motorists outside had in mind for the Lhasa country's destiny. Instead, banishing fire from the mountains to save the forest for the sawmills and gaining access for autos and trucks seemed certain to smother the wildness of the Lhasa with roads, dust, the roar of engines, the smell of gasoline, and other manifestations of government order. Neither the rangers, the industrialists, nor the auto-oriented public had room in their definition of progress for Malone's feeling you don't get anywhere else. When overrun by, quote, progress, in the past, trappers and others who cherished wild places had no choice but to move out of the way. Yet the inevitability of losing the last of America's frontiers to the road builders was not accepted by all citizens of the United States. Indeed, the ranks of men and women who recognized spiritual, recreational, and even economic value in raw nature, were growing too. More than motors and gears and road-building scrapers rattled outside the Lhasa country. A new national movement was underway, and its participants pledged to prevent roads and machines from civilizing many special places. Few, if any, of those who challenged the supremacy of the engine and wheel knew or cared how to snap a trap on a marten or lynx. In truth, woodsmanship was uncommon among them. They were, in general, people enjoyed recreational activities in unroaded mountains, but, more important, many were able activists in matters of politics, science, government, law, philosophy, and the molding of public opinion. The roots of their convictions were seeded in the cultures of biblical times and grew, always with conflict, to maturity in the wilds of America. Throughout the history of Western civilization, humanity's goal on Earth had been to, quote, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the Earth and subdue it, and therefore order nature in the interest of humans. Wilderness and paradise were viewed as physical and spiritual opposites. After Adam ate the forbidden fruit, God sent him and Eve from the Garden of Eden to, quote, till the ground from whence he was taken. Yet wild places had their merits too. Moses, for example, went into the wilderness and received the Ten Commandments from God on Mount Sinai. From the outset of modern people's interaction with it, wilderness has harbored divergent values. It is at once a place useful only when ordered in the interest of humanity, as well as a place to obtain personal freedom and to draw close to God. The first immigrants to the United States fled Europe to escape oppression, but their tithe for freedom was long hours of labor, creating enclaves in the unexplored lands of America. Their food, clothing, shelter, safety, and comfort all depended on conquering the wilderness. Although the pioneers admired nature, their relentless purpose was to order nature and in that way make the wilderness habitable and useful to civilized people. Henry David Thoreau was among the first to challenge the wisdom of degrading pristine land for materialistic gain. To better understand nature, he built a hut in 1845 at age 19 at Walden Pond, Massachusetts, and lived there in solitude until 1847. While at Walden, he wrote extensively. Capably expressed in his writing, Thoreau's thinking contributed new values to the American scene, then dominated by the quest for money, security, and prosperity. His most revealing statement on nature is found in one of his essays. The West of which I speak is but another name for the wild, and what I have been preparing to say is that in wildness is the preservation of the world. With these words, Thoreau sowed the seed of an idea that natural places were good for, even essential to, fulfillment in life. In 1877, when Chief Joseph led the Free Nez Perce in their last trip over the road to the Buffalo, a new champion of wild places was expanding the principles set forth by Thoreau. Scotland-born John Muir got a taste of life on the American frontier when in 1849 his family moved to a homestead in central Wisconsin. Though caught up at age 11 in the toil of clearing the wilderness, Muir was happy in wild places and considered the encroachment of civilization arbitrary and cruel. With spiritual views similar to the Nez Perce's, Muir revered raw nature as God's most perfect creation. He saw no conflict between nature and religion, and he would rather learn of the power of God through contact with natural wonders than from the study of the Bible. Like Thoreau, Muir spoke and wrote persuasively. But to live and philosophize for 2 years in a cabin on Walden Pond would never do it for Muir. Instead, he explored the wild regions of the western United States, especially those in California, and publicized their virtues. Meanwhile, on March 1, 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant had created the world's first large wilderness park by signing an act designating over 2 million acres in Wyoming and Montana territories as Yellowstone National Park. 13 years later, the state of New York established 715,000 acres as a forest preserve in the Adirondacks, specifying that it remained forever wild. Citizen support leading to these designations did not dwell on the cultural, spiritual, or recreational value of wild places, but instead was motivated by a desire to prevent the exploitation of natural wonders. These events proved, however, that wild country could be saved even in fortune-hunting frontier America. By the fall of 1890, Muir was promoting expansion of the national park idea and had argued for establishment of Yosemite National Park. His arguments left no doubt that the prime value of the park was to be its wildness. On September 3, 1890, President Benjamin Harrison signed the bill creating Yosemite National Park, the first preserve designated specifically to protect the values of wilderness. Creation of Yosemite was a political endorsement of public sentiment. Sentiments like those of Earl Malone and Fay Burrell, some 20 years later as they pulled their toboggan across Blodgett Pass. Yet greater recognition by the people of the values of wildness was needed, and John Muir worked tirelessly towards that end. Muir would have been happy to see the forest preserved in their natural state, but he also recognized the material needs of expanding America. He thus sought compromise with Pinchot, Furneaux, and other forestry leaders to ensure that the reserves would be, quote, be made to yield a sure harvest of timber, while at the same time all their far-reaching uses may be maintained unimpaired. Muir's notion that wildness and commercial forestry could coexist on the forest reserves didn't last long. As we have already seen, on Chapter 7, on June 4, 1897, Congress passed the Organic Administration Act, declaring that the primary purposes of the reserves were, quote, securing favorable conditions of water flow and to furnish a continuous supply of timber. The act provided that the forest would remain open to existing uses such as mining and grazing. There was no mention in the act of the value of wild places. To make matters worse for wild country, Furneaux's position as forester in charge of the reserves was that, quote, the main service, the principal object of the forest has nothing to do with beauty or pleasure. It is not, except incidentally, an object of aesthetics, but an object of economics. Convinced that in management of the reserves by the utility-minded foresters lay the sure demise of wild places, Muir withdrew all support for Pinchot and his followers and thereafter labored for official recognition of wilderness. Despite Pinchot's calculated strategy to suppress the idea of preserving wilderness, the National Conservation Program had split by the time Fay Burrell and Earl Malone discovered Big Sand Lake. The wilderness movement was underway, and its leader, John Muir, was saying, quote, thousands of tired, nerve-shaking, over-civilized people are beginning to find out that going to the mountains is going home, that wildness is a necessity, and that mountain parks and reservations are useful not only as fountains of timber and irrigating rivers, but as foundations of life. The foresters could not suppress, nor would they long ignore, the groundswell of citizen opinion supporting Muir's crusade. The beginning of the idea of multiple use of the national forest came to Gifford Pinchot during the winter of 1907, while riding his saddle horse Jim on the Ridge Road in Rock Creek Park, Washington, D.C. Pondering the relationship between forestry and other natural resources, he struck on the thought that the many questions fitted into and made up the one great central problem of the use of the earth for the good of man. He called the concept conservation. Though he had no truck with preserving wilderness, his concept of conservation would provide an administrative means to coordinate management of the many forest uses and resources, including wildlife, recreation, and wilderness. In a move sure to generate competition between government agencies for control of much of the western wilderness, Congress created the National Park Service in 1916. It directed that all national parks were to be managed to, quote, conserve the scenery and the natural and historic objects and the wildlife therein, and to provide for the enjoyment of the same in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. Now, the land of the Lhasa and a great many similar jewels of wild country were situated in the National Forest, and Muir and his associates had their eyes on those places. So did Stephen Mather, the energetic director of the Park Service. And the Forest Service countered the new agency's thrust by publicizing scenery and outdoor recreation as major amenities available in the national forests. Not long after the turn of the century, public opinion and intergovernmental competition had relegated to history Forester Furneaux's pronouncement concerning the utilitarian nature of forestry. But the true transformation of the Foresters began in 1918 with the assignment of landscape architect Arthur Carhart to survey vacation home sites at Trappers Lake, Colorado. Struck by the beauty and wildness of the place, Carhart recommended to District 2 Forester Carl J. Stahl that the best use of the Trappers Lake area was for wilderness recreation, not summer homes. Stahl agreed, and by administrative designation in early 1920s, he applied the preservation principle for the first time to a national forest. Forester Aldo Leopold in neighboring District 3 shared Carhart's vision of preserving some wild places in the National Forest as wilderness. At once expressing support for industrial development and protection of wildlands, Leopold said, quote, "While reduction of the wilderness has been a good thing, its extermination would be a very bad one." Due largely to Leopold's efforts, on June 3, 1924, District 3 Forester Frank C.W. Pooler designated 574,000 acres within New Mexico as the Gila Wilderness to be used primarily for wilderness recreation. Late in 1926, Chief Forester William Greeley expressed approval of the Gila Wilderness and encouraged other districts to establish similar reservations. In an article in Sunset Magazine in 1927, he called for a new point of view. Quote, "The frontier has long ceased to be a barrier to civilization. The question is rather how much of it should be kept to preserve our civilization." By 1929, the year in which Ranger McKay led the retreat from the Great Fires of the Lhasa, the Forest Service had recognized that natural landscapes had value in and of themselves. This recognition was embodied in the agency's L-20 regulations, which established an official policy of preserving wild places throughout the national forests. But the rangers in the field hadn't yet been informed of this rather startling policy development, nor could they have anticipated it. After all, the value of the Lhasa's forest for commercial timber had been extolled and mapped by Lieberg in 1897, Shattuck in 1910, and the Forest Service itself in 1915, 24, and later. Yet no one had even described, much less mapped, the values of the Lhasa's wild country. Let's see here. Let's skip a bit. Okay. "An appreciation of wildness lies an irony of American civilization. The trappers, usually a poor lot by economic standards, necessarily joined with nature and thus came to love the freedom and mystery of wild land and to revel in the hardship it thrusts upon them. The trappers of the Lhasa and of the mountains west, generally, were the pathfinders who fell so in love with the land as it was that, could they have done so, many would have gated their pathways to bar entry to the pilgrims, who were sure to follow their blazes. But most settlers and many foresters wanted the wilderness opened up so that its resources could be available for utilitarian use, as reflected in the purpose and provisions of the Organic Administration Act of 1897. It remained, then, for the more wealthy residents of urban America, people blessed with money but denied nature, to fight hardest for the wilderness cause. Thus, the deepest appreciation for wildness existed at the bottom and near the top of the economic spectrum in American culture. The trappers, few in number and awed by politics, rarely spoke out for their wild land. Those on the other end of the culture and economic scale often did. Born of wealthy parents in New York City on January 2, 1901, Bob Marshall was one of those who spoke the loudest and worked the hardest for wilderness. Like trapper Fay Burrell, who discovered Big Sand Lake at age 16, Bob Marshall, with his brother George, climbed Mount Ampersand in the Adirondacks at age 15. Climbing mountains and exploring and defending wild places became the principal occupation of Bob's life. By October of 1937, he had taken 230-mile walks, 51 40-mile walks, and a number of longer walks, including one of at least 70 miles. Marshall began government service in 1924, and from 1925 to 1928, he worked at the Forest Service's Northern Rocky Mountain Forest and Range Experiment Station in Missoula, Montana, where he was surrounded by some of the largest expanses of unroaded mountain areas in the continental U.S. Missoula provided an ideal location for Marshall to explore wild country and promote its protection as wilderness. Moreover, from Missoula, Marshall could see the northern crests of the Bitterroot Range, whose western slopes drained into the Lhoksa. If any part of that land were to remain wild, it was going to need all the help it could get. In an article published in the Scientific Monthly in February 1930, Marshall tried to define wilderness. He began, "For the ensuing discussion, I shall use the word wilderness to denote a region which contains no permanent inhabitants, possesses no possibility of conveyance by any mechanical means, and is sufficiently spacious that a person in crossing it must have the experience of sleeping out. The dominant attributes of such an area are, first, that it requires anyone who exists in it to depend exclusively on his own effort for survival, and second, that it preserves as nearly as possible the primitive environment. This means that all roads, power transportation, and settlements are barred. But trails and temporary shelters, which were common long before the advent of the white race, are entirely permissible." He explained that the masses of American motorists already had access to more roads than they could drive in a lifetime. His paper ended, quote, "There is just one hope of repulsing the tyrannical ambition of civilization to conquer every mile of the whole earth. That hope is the organization of spirited people who will fight for the freedom of the wilderness." Such was the creed of Bob Marshall. After leaving his post at Missoula, Marshall continued his crusade for wilderness while serving in Washington, D.C. as director of the Forestry Division of the U.S. Office of Indian Affairs. Recognizing the need for promoting recreation use, Forest Chief Silcox in 1937 created the Division of Recreational Lands in Washington, D.C. He signed Marshall on as the division's first director. From 1937 until his untimely death in 1939, Bob Marshall enjoyed a unique opportunity to create wilderness areas in the national forests. Probably no one in the United States was as well qualified for that job. Through personal exploration, he had acquired firsthand knowledge of many wild areas. His educational background was excellent. During his 2-year tenure as chief of the Division of Recreation and Lands, Marshall achieved administrative designation as wilderness of over 5 million acres in the national forests. He also prepared the U regulations, issued in September 1939, which defined several kinds of recreation areas, directed their management, and prohibited road building and logging in all areas designated wilderness or wild. So by the time the Lhoksa Rangers mopped up the fires of 1934, a strong policy to preserve wilderness had developed in the Forest Service, with several areas in the National Forest already designated as such. Nonetheless, the thrust for more and better access to the National Forest continued. During the winter of 1934-35, Ranger Mackey reported that his Powell district already contained 133 miles of road and 600 miles of trail, and that more would be needed for fire control. Still, a different view of the value of nature's creations, distilled from the philosophy of Thoreau, the spirit of Muir, the wisdom of Leopold, and the action of Marshall, was beginning to make its mark on the rangers of the Lhoksa. That Marshall understood the richness of wildness in the Lhoksa shows in his journal of a hike he made in 1930. "It was the last evening of my journey, and I was sitting quietly in the dusk that had gathered in the narrow valley of Big Sand Lake. The somber mountainsides, covered by parallel, overlapping spires of dark green spruce and alpine fir, they rose abruptly from the very edge of the water to an indefinite region, where they were merged with fog. The lake was one gray shadow, except for the bright salmon-colored horns of a giant bull moose, which slowly wallowed through the lily pads just off the densely wooded shoreline. Everything he did was deliberate and had a dignity appropriate to an environment which measured changes by the century instead of the hour. A gangly-legged calf was splashing in the shallows and looking up every now and then with curiosity. Nightbirds circled. The last mosquitoes of summer hummed their farewell song. A gentle wind rippled the placid water. The old bull turned slowly and disappeared into the black forest. The calf lingered uncertainly for a few moments, then uttered a queer snort and followed. The trees across the lake lost their identity, and darkness imperceptibly had fallen, no differently than during millions of evenings before the intrusion of man." Now, Marshall pressed hard for designation of much of the land of the Locksaws Wilderness. He influenced Chief Silcox to stop the construction of the truck trails penetrating the pristine mountains south of the Locksaw River. And on June 11th, Acting Chief Earl Clapp designated the Forest Service's largest primitive area, the 1.875 million acres astride the Bitterroot Mountains, including much of the Locksaw and Selway drainages and the canyon country in the slopes of the Bitterroot Valley east of the crest. Known as the Selway Bitterroot Primitive Area, 1.585 million acres lay in Idaho and another 290,000 acres in Montana. Several roads threaded within its boundaries, including the 20-mile-long truck trail from Powell Ranger Station to Elk Summit. Shearer, Moose Creek, and Fish Lake landing fields remained open to both governmental and private aircraft. The designation placed no restrictions on several existing uses and activities, including game management projects, hazard reduction projects, controlled burning, snag felling, fire line control, construction of new landing fields needed for fire control and irrigation canals or conduits. While striking a blow for wildness, the Forest Service nevertheless retained plenty of options for exploitation that could degrade the natural values of that land. When in 1939 the strengthened UR regulations were implemented, the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness was eligible for better protection. To qualify, it had to be reduced in size to exclude roads previously built to control fires. The rangers would continue to fight fires in wilderness, but now there could be no truck trails nor trucks to carry men and equipment in and out of the mountains. Further building of roads was stopped in the protected area, but not in time to save some wild places cherished by those early mountain men. The new regulations recognize, as many people long had, that wildness dies in the presence of machines. As Trapper Faye Burrell put it, referring to the truck trail to Elk Summit, quote, "I was in there so much it was like home. Then after they built that road in there, I was blue for a month. That road, it killed it for me." By designating the Selway Bitterroot Primitive Area, the government of the United States ratified as a public value Trapper Malone's conviction that, quote, "There's something about that country that gives you a feeling you don't get anywhere else. In at least a portion of the Locksaws Mountains, humanity and its machinery would no longer, quote, tear at the earth where the life lies hidden." It is unfortunate that, during their fight to keep the country wild, the Trappers and Bob Marshall never got better acquainted. Each in his own way, the affluent Marshall, with his knowledge and zeal, and the solitude-rich, dollar-poor Trapper, with his homespun philosophy, affirmed the value of wildness in the land of the Locksaw. Henceforth, there would always be wild country over the hill from the Bitterroot Valley. And that is from the book The Locksaw Story, Land Ethics in the Bitterroot Mountains by Bud Moore. Now, before we take a musical break here, I will conclude that segment by just adding that the Wilderness Act was passed by Congress in 1964, as we mentioned earlier in the show. The Selway Bitterroot Wilderness was immediately designated wilderness with the signing of the act by President Lyndon B. Johnson. And all of its roughly 1.3 million acres was added to the National Wilderness Preservation System. At that time, 9.1 million acres were added to the system when it became an act, when it became a law, and the Selway Bitterroot contained one-ninth or a 1 million out of those 9 million acres. So just another little tidbit to inspire you, to encourage you to take action, to join us to help defeat the Sportsman's Heritage Act. It certainly is the greatest threat right now to the National Wilderness Preservation System, and places like the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, and the Gospel Hump Wilderness. So please go to wildernesswatch.org and see how you can make a difference in hoping to turn back the Sportsman's Heritage Act. So let's take another music break, and when we get back, we'll continue the Wild Clearwater Country Show. This is KRFP Moscow.
the stars all sleep as a new day comes. Wipe down this room that never ends. And listen to the voice that the spirit sends.
All right, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. You're listening to KRFP Moscow. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to learn more about the work of Friends of the Clearwater, check them out, www.friendsoftheclearwater.org. And the group, our group, is getting ready to launch a brand new website with Buffalo Girls Production. That should happen within the next week or two. The website will be completely different. A giant transformation has occurred or is on the verge of occurring. But one thing that is the same is the web address. So it is www.friendsoftheclearwater.org. And between now and maybe the next 14 days, you will see a brand new website appear. And hopefully that inspires you and encourages you to get more involved in the public lands decision-making process. So speaking of public lands, I had the fortune of sitting in a meeting yesterday up in Missoula, Montana, with a bunch of conservation leaders from throughout the Northern Rockies bioregion. And one of them was Mike Garrity with the Alliance for the Wild Rockies. Now, you might be familiar with the Alliance for the Wild Rockies work. Certainly Friends of the Clearwater works hand in hand with the Alliance. We've had Mike here as a guest on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We certainly will do hope to try and get him on the show again later this year. One recent accomplishment by the Alliance for the Wild Rockies is they were able to get a preliminary injunction, might be a permanent injunction at this point, but a preliminary injunction to halt the hazing of wild buffalo back into Yellowstone National Park. That might ring a bell with the Buffalo Field Campaign and all the work that they've been doing over the past 15 years to cease that hazing operation. But the Alliance for the Wild Rockies used a different tool in the fact that they convinced the judge that the hazing of the buffalo, the wild buffalo herds, was also having a detrimental effect on grizzly bears, which are protected under the Endangered Species Act. And so the judge ruled in favor of Alliance for the Wild Rockies and then issued an injunction there for halting continued use of helicopters to get the bison off of the national forest lands and back into the national park. So nonetheless, what I wanted to share with you was the executive director's report from Mike Garrity, who's the executive director for the Alliance for the Wild Rockies. This is coming out of their new summer newsletter. Congress wrote the National Environmental Policy Act to make the government consider every significant environmental impact of any proposed action and to ensure that federal agencies inform and fully involve the public in the decision-making process. The purpose of the National Forest Management Act is to ensure that our national forests continue to have viable populations of native species. The Endangered Species Act was signed into law by President Nixon to protect threatened and endangered species in the ecosystem upon which they depend. Congress placed citizen suit provisions in virtually all federal environmental laws, including these statutes, because citizens are often the only group willing to police the government. If someone throws a brick through a window, the police would enforce the law. But when the federal government breaks the law, citizens are often the only enforcers. As the federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals famously wrote, citizens, quote, stand in the shoes, unquote, of regulatory enforcement agencies to enforce the law, and to do so without any prospect of a personal benefit. Now, as the court recognized, we get no financial benefit when we win a lawsuit against the federal government. Our attorneys get their fee pays, but we get nothing to cover the alliance's costs. Instead, we depend on our members to support our enforcement efforts. Now facing shrinking budgets for federal regulatory agencies, little congressional oversight, and scarce resources for citizens to protect their healthy property and the full panoply of publicly owned lands, waters, and the diverse plant and animal communities that rely on them, citizen suits play an increasing role in environmental protection. Unfortunately, a disturbing trend has appeared as big environmental groups increasingly alter their role from fierce advocates for environmental protection to, quote, collaboration with federal agencies, such as the Forest Service, much like the Vichy French helped occupy France during World War II. Now, the driving force behind this trend is primarily financial. More and more studies are confirming that the lion's share of grants from foundation funders are going to a tiny handful of large environmental groups instead of smaller grassroots groups that fight tooth and nail to protect their local environments. Thus, instead of using their resources to ensure that environmental laws are enforced, the mega groups are actually helping the federal government evade them by, quote, going along to get along, with continuing resource extraction and environmental destruction. So why are foundations so deeply invested in large groups that continue to lose ground on environmental policy every year? Because traditional political, quote, wisdom is that these groups help their congressional friends to get reelected regardless of their corporate ties. The sad reality is that these groups often confuse, quote, access, which they buy with millions in foundation money, with, quote, influence on policy issues. Behind it all is a very simple truth. Corporations want access to public lands unencumbered by environmental laws, and NEPA, NFMA, and the ESA mean nothing unless they are enforced. Now, the National Forest Management Act was passed in 1976 with the goal of, quote, sustained yield of resources from our national forests. But that didn't just mean harvesting timber. It meant continuing to sustain clean water, native species, and the habitat they require. The Forest Service, however, continued business as usual at the behest of corporate interests and their political allies, and continued to allow massive clear cuts that degraded watershed after watershed until environmental groups stepped in to enforce federal environmental laws. Unfortunately, collaborative environmental groups no longer try to enforce federal environmental laws. They do no independent research when they support Forest Service timber sales, merely give their, quote, green stamp of approval, and then put their hand out to big foundations for their collaboration paycheck. For example, in the Colt Summit timber sale in the Sealy Swan Valley in western Montana, the Forest Service proposes logging in federally designated lynx critical habitat. In the meeting notes in the project record, the word lynx never came up in the discussions between the collaborators and the Forest Service. Even though the Endangered Species Act requires the Forest Service to not adversely modify critical habitat, yet the agency's own research shows that the logging proposal does exactly that, since lynx avoid logged forests. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to enforce the Endangered Species Act, but because its budget has been slashed and the agency is subject to political pressure to, quote, get the cut out, they also do no independent research of Forest Service proposals and rubber stamp almost everything that comes across their desk. The green stamp of approval from the collaborators allows the Forest Service to avoid following environmental laws. But if any citizen group, such as the Alliance, tries to enforce the law, the federal government, their environmental collaborators, and political cohorts go on a public relations campaign calling the citizen group radicals and extremists who are destroying our country rather than citizens who are policing the government as the law intended. Now you tell me what would be more patriotic. Thanks to financial support from American citizens, the Alliance for the Wild Rockies is using the laws that Congress passed to force the federal government to protect clean water, native species, and the ecosystems that they depend on. This is how a democracy works. Thank you for all of your help. We couldn't do it without you. Please make a donation to help us protect public lands. Check them out. www.wildrockiesalliance.org. And nice job, Mike Garrity. Great to see you yesterday and all the folks up there that are working so hard to protect the remaining wildlands here in the Northern Rockies bioregion. It is a very special place. Wild Clearwater Country is just a small sliver or an important component of the Northern Rockies bioregion, and that Salmon Selway greater ecosystem is the reason why organizations like Friends of the Clearwater exist, why we have this Wild Clearwater Country show to be able to speak with you, share some of this information with you so that you also can hopefully get inspired and join hands with us to protect what's left of wild places like the Wheatus Creek Roadless Area, the Meadow Creek Roadless Area, the Kelly Creek Roadless Area, Pot Mountain Roadless Area, the Mallard Larkins Roadless Area, the Fish and Hungry Creek Roadless Area, so on and so forth. So it's been a good show today. Certainly hope you have enjoyed it. I'm getting ready to get the boot here. You can catch the Wild Clearwater Country Show every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. And when Friends of the Clearwater launches their new website, www.friendsoftheclearwater.org, it will also contain a radio show archive of all of our radio shows here in KRFP Moscow. So if you missed the show live, you can go on the website and just hit play and stream it through an audio player, and you can listen to it on your own time, on your convenience. So with that note, thank you very much for listening. And now let's segue into the weather report. Tonight, partly cloudy with low around 41, winds out of the west between 5 and 13, gusting as high as 24. Tomorrow, 50% chance of showers with an increase in clouds, high near 66. Winds out of the east between 9 and 14, winds gusting as high as 20 miles an hour tomorrow. Thursday night, showers likely, cloudy with low around 44, winds out of the west between 8 and 11 miles an hour. Chance of precip Thursday night, 70%. Friday, 40% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 59, winds out of the west between 6 and 9. Friday night, 40% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with low around 40, winds out of the west between 8 and 10. Saturday, showers likely, mainly after 11 a.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 51, chance of precip on Saturday 60%. Saturday night, showers likely, mostly cloudy with low around 41. I just read that, didn't I? Sunday, 20% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 58. Sunday night, 20% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with low around 43. You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
We are now no longer the knights who say Nikkei. We are now the knights who say
KRFP Moscow.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis.